Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. Today, joining me is Jimmy Akin, senior apologist to Catholic Answers. And we're going to talk about apologetics methodology. So we talk a lot about defending the Catholic faith, defending Christianity here on the channel. But we don't often talk about the disagreements different Christians have when it comes to how we do that. How do we make a defense? What are the different ways we can do that? And you might have noticed that difference recently in my debate with Jay Dyer. So Jay is an Eastern Orthodox apologist, but he embraces a view of apologetics that focuses on presuppositionalism. So our debate that you got to listen to here on the channel recently was about the project of natural theology. Can we use reason to come to know that God exists? Can Christians and atheists start on an equal footing with reason and reason our way to God's existence? Or do we have to do something else in order to do that? So I thought it'd be fun to have Jimmy come on the show today to talk about the debate a little bit, talk about methodology, because I think a lot of the concepts that came up in the debate about these differences might have flown, you know, things were kind of moving the fast and furious, if you will, and some of the concepts that might have been dropped here and there throughout the debate, you all may not have heard of. So that's why I love having little debrief sessions so we can go even deeper into the topic. Jimmy, thanks for coming back to the show.
Hey, it's my pleasure, Trent, anytime.
So you had a chance to watch the debate that I had with Dyer, and you also have a lot of experience in studying apologetics and these different views. Maybe you can talk about both a little bit and help people to understand who might think, wait, I thought there was only like one, we just did apologetics. It might not know about the methodology question.
Yeah, there are several different approaches to apologetics, and you mentioned the name of the one that Dyer seems to favor, which is called presuppositionalism. And it differs from the classical way of doing apologetics. There are about five or six different primary methodologies that get used, and classical apologetics is one of them. Presuppositionalism is another one that has come up in, it's gained some popularity in the last few decades. It's still a minority position. And I think for good reason. It has some interesting contributions to make, but it also has some interesting limitations. The basic idea in classical methodology is you start with proving the existence of God, which is the most, for defending the Christian faith, you start with proving the existence of God, and then you begin to narrow down what you're proving to arrive at a more specific result. So you prove theism, that God exists and that he interacts with the world. Then you move on to proving that Jesus is the Christ, and then you move on to proving, if you're Catholic, that the Catholic Church is the church that Jesus established. So that's kind of the classical methodology. You start broad and you get narrow. Presuppositionalism approaches the question from a different angle and says, well, we need to start by talking about what we're presupposing, because every view, I mean, no view starts from the ground up. Everyone presupposes certain things, and so we should talk about those presuppositions, and in order to make sense of the world, you need to presuppose either the truth of God's word as found in Scripture. That's one common way of presenting presuppositionalism, right. Or you need to presuppose a certain type of deity, like a triune God. But then once you've made that presupposition, it explains the world as we see it, and other competing claims don't explain the world unless you make that initial presupposition. So that's kind of an overview. Now, of course, apart from the issue of what methodologies should be used in presenting apologetics, there's then the question of technique, of how you present it. And since you mentioned you'd like this to be a bit of a debrief on the debate you had, I thought I'd comment on that.
Sure.
And so when I watch debates, I'm watching on multiple levels. On the one hand, I'm looking for substance, you know, who is presenting the arguments for their position in a substantive way, who's laying good arguments and data on the table. But I'm also looking at it in terms of delivery. You know, how is this going to come across to the audience for this debate? Who's being most persuasive? Who's honoring the rules of the debate? Who's breaking them and things like that? Mm-hmm. And then also for online debates, I watch the comm box and I see how people are responding. And most people who come to a debate, or I can't say most, but many people who come to a debate are really already convinced strongly of a position. And so they're going to root for whoever is advocating their position, no matter what happens.
It's kind of like at a football game. The ref is always wrong when he rules against your team.
Yeah, exactly. So you have diehard people who are going to cheer whichever person they're in favor of, no matter what happens in the debate. But I'm more interested in when people admit things contrary to their preferences, because that tends to be more significant. If something's happened and someone says, well, even though I agree with this guy, I think my guy just blew it, or this other guy just made a really good point.
Right.
That's more significant. In the case of your debate with Dwyer, so you both had 15-minute opening statements.
Right.
And Dwyer went first. He was advocating the proposition that Christians should not use what's called natural theology. Natural theology is a way of looking at nature and reasoning to the existence of God. And this is used in the Bible itself. St. Paul does this, for example. And it's been widely used by Christian apologists and philosophers down through the ages.
Right.
Now, Dwyer began by saying, I'm not saying that there's no such thing as natural theology or that it could never be used in any circumstances. And that's an important admission.
Right.
Because it makes his case more tenable, since he's not going directly against St. Paul. He's acknowledging there is a way you could do this. Mm-hmm. You just need to frame it correctly.
Right.
And so then, as a debater, what he would need to do is say clearly to the audience, and here's how that is, and
right.
here's how you need to frame it. And if you don't frame it this way, you're doing it wrong. And then he would be off and running, and he could explore that position and defend it. Well, people who are familiar with my work will know how I really try to be charitable and I really try to be gentle.
Sure.
And I'm going to say something now that actually is charitable, because it's a message Dwyer needs to hear, whether from me or from someone else. So it is charitable. It's meant to help him, but it's not going to be gentle, because if I said it too gently, it wouldn't have its impact. As I was watching the comm box in the middle of Dwyer's opening statement, mm-hmm. someone said, wow, Trent has already won. Mm. And it wasn't just a flippant remark. There was a reason the person was saying it. I would have qualified it a little more. I would have said, well, Trent's already won if Dwyer doesn't radically alter course later in the debate. Because Dwyer's opening statement was absolutely incoherent. He was rushing through a prepared statement. He was using all kinds of fancy jargon that he was not defining for the audience.
Right.
He was constantly name-dropping other people and things they had written, which were not in evidence. I mean,
right.
you can say, oh, someone wrote in this paper that proves my point. Great. That doesn't prove it to the audience in the debate you're having.
Right.
You can't just cite people that way without, as if that's proof. And he was inarticulate in expressing his own position. He was all over the map. The analogy that occurred to me was this is like trying to drink from a fire hose.
Right.
You're going to get a little bit of it, but it is just an overwhelming onslaught torrent of information. And it was just bafflegab.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a terrible performance. Now, he did get somewhat better.
Right.
Later in the discussion. So I want to give that to him. Mm-hmm. But if he's going to debate people, the only people he's ever going to convince are people who are already convinced of his position. Because this is not how you win people over. This is a terrible performance. You have to come down to the level that the audience is at. You don't try to impress them by using a lot of bafflegab.
Yeah, because I think what's actually impressive is, right, when you can clearly communicate with them. And that's why I tried very hard in shaving and working on my opening statement so it would do that.
Yeah, and that's part of the debate process. There's always more you can say than you're going to have time for. So you have to pare it back. You have to bring it down. You have to strip out the jargon so that it's going to be understandable to people. And you did, just speaking not on the substance level, but on the delivery level, you did much better than that. And I would see, you know, it was night and day in comparison. And I saw people in the comm box commenting on how, wow, this is so much easier. Trent is speaking slowly and clearly. He's so much easier to understand. Dyer was all over the map. And I have to say that that was an accurate assessment. I am not impressed when an apologist uses big words. I'm impressed when an apologist brings it down to a level where people can understand it. And that can be challenging at times, but it's a necessary effort, and it's a mark of actual apologetic skill to be able to take something and make it intelligible, even if it's heady in its original presentation. Yeah. And that was simply absent in this debate on Dyer's part. He completely did not do that.
Yeah, and that's what made it frustrating, and I was trying hard throughout the debate to help people to try to understand where we were at, especially, and we'll talk about this more here as we continue on, about the difference between classical apologetics and presuppositional apologetics. Because when you talk about presuppositions, there are many terms like jargon or technical terms that are used that I think can sound very impressive to people, but then they can't grasp what's actually being talked about, using terms like meta logic, for example, paradigms and things like that.
Those were terms that came up in the debate. Also, at one point, Dyer referred to JTB and the Gettier problem. And it's like, unless you've taken epistemology recently, you're going to have no idea what that's a reference to. JTB is an informal anachronism or acronym that is used casually in grad school for justified true belief, which is the classic expression of Plato's definition of knowledge. The Gettier problem, or Gettier problem, depending on which pronunciation you prefer, is a recent puzzle in the philosophy of knowledge that came up in the 1960s in a little short paper by a philosopher named Edmund Gettier.
Right.
And it challenges the classical definition of knowledge and says, hey, there's something missing here. But to just, in the course of a debate, casually toss off a reference to JTB and the Gettier problem, the audience is going to have no idea what you're talking about.
Right. And so that's why I tried very hard to stay away from those kind of things and just make specific points, and then really focus on that I do feel like in this discussion, because especially with someone like Dyer and other people who follow him, I appreciate that Jay debates atheists, that his followers want to do apologetics. And so I think that that is a very good thing. The thing that I'm most concerned about is, let's try to use the method that's going to be the most effective with the people that we're trying to reach, whether they're, especially if we're both, well, I guess a lot of them are Eastern Orthodox and we're Catholic. The people we're going to reach are either Protestants or usually, let's say, like atheists or non-believers. What's going to be most persuasive to them? And I hope to show in the debate that this kind of presuppositional approach, I don't think it's going to be persuasive on its own, or if you retrofit it enough to make it persuasive, I think that to say that it's different than natural theology, it's like a difference without a distinction. You're still doing the same kinds of things of saying, here's stuff in the world, it can't be explained on its own, here's why only a certain concept of God can explain. At least that's what I was trying to run through in the rest of the debate.
And I think that thoughtful presuppositionalists acknowledge that, I mean, I've seen thoughtful presuppositionalists say this, and Dyer seemed to even say this himself, that there is a role for natural theology reasoning.
Yeah.
So the views actually converge. And at that point, I find myself saying, okay, well, it's a presuppositionalist can say, sure, there is a role for natural theology, and then a classical apologist who embraces natural theology, I think, could certainly be open to the proposition that, yeah, there are certain presuppositions that will make better sense of the world than others. Like, you know, if we start with the assumption, or at least openness to the assumption, that God exists, or that God has given us his word or something like that, that will make better sense of the data we see in front of us. And so I see a convergence between these two viewpoints. And at that point, it's really a question of, well, which is more useful in reaching ordinary people? Now, it could happen, because people are different.
Right.
It could happen that a given person needs to hear things approached from a presuppositional point of view. And so the first thing you would do with this person is say, have you thought about your underlying presuppositions? Let's think for a minute. Suppose there was a God, or suppose there was a Trinitarian God, or suppose that God has given us his word in the Bible. Mm-hmm. Let's think about how that would make sense of the world. And for some people, that could be a constructive approach. For many people, though, who aren't yet convinced that there's a God and aren't open to that possibility,
right,
it can be helpful to start at the other end of the discussion and say, well, let's look at the world. Does the world have any aspects to it that suggest it has a creator? And then proceed from that perspective. And at least sociologically and historically, based on the way most apologists in history have approached the question, including biblical ones, it seems that the latter is what's helpful most of the time.
Right.
It doesn't. Most people are not helped by, let's suppose there's a Trinitarian God as our first move.
Right.
More people are persuaded by, let's consider whether the world has a creator as our first move. And so if that's the case, then it seems to me that presuppositionalists are making a perhaps interesting point, mm-hmm, that, you know, this set of presuppositions helps make sense of the world better than others, but that's not of practical relevance to the case of most individuals.
Right.
So it's an interesting theoretical point to discuss and debate, but it really doesn't tell you that much about how to actually do apologetics with real people.
Yeah. I think there were, because as I tried to understand Jay's case for presuppositionalism as opposed to the classical view, I could really only derive maybe two arguments from everything that he put forward. One was this concern that the word God, and this was hard, I think, for anyone to follow. He was throwing out epistemological terms like rigid designator, flaccid designator.
Oh, yeah. And got to find an alternative to saying flaccid designator.
Yeah, I don't want to.
Just got to. Not bad apologetics technique. Flaccid designators.
I don't want to talk. I usually don't want to be in discussions where we're talking about flaccid versus rigid anyways. But so the concern here, and this deals with the problem of terms and their reference, and what does the word God mean? Because it's kind of an unusual word. Like, we have words like senior apologist at Catholic Answers and Jimmy Akin, or another word for Jimmy Akin, you know, the son of so-and-so, that you have different terms that refer to the same individual. And it seemed like Dyer's concern was just that the word God, that it's just synonymous with a particular view of the Trinity. And if natural theology arguments can't get you to the Trinity, they're not really getting you to God. It was hard to tease out what he was trying to say.
And that's because of how incoherent he was in presenting his case. He did talk a lot about different understandings of the term God, and he made some points that were valid but irrelevant, or I should say that were true but irrelevant. He pointed out that that just because Muslims believe in God and Jews believe in God and Protestants and Catholics and Orthodox believe in God, it doesn't mean they all believe in the same God. And this is true. They could believe in different gods. So he would illustrate this by pointing to a fallacy. And the fallacy, I mean, you can express it by different names, but the basic idea would go something like, well, Jimmy Akin is the son of a mother, and Trent Horn is the son of a mother, and Jay Dyer is the son of a mother, but that doesn't mean they're all the son of the same mother.
Right.
And it would be a fallacy to say, oh, I've got these three data points, therefore there must be this one universal mother of all of them.
Another way I've heard it phrased is every student in class has a pencil, but it does not follow there is one pencil that every student is using.
Yeah. And so, that's fallacious reasoning. What I've noticed, and I should write an article about this, is often apologists for various positions will accuse other people of committing fallacies when that's really not what they're doing.
Right.
And in this case, yes, it's true. Hypothetically, it does not follow as a matter of logical necessity that just because Muslims, Jews, and Christians all believe in a God, that it's the same God. But the question then is, what are the definite descriptions of this God? Do they point to the same one? Because I have a brother named Brian Patrick, and goes by Patrick. And so Jimmy Akin is the son of a mother. Patrick Akin is the son of a mother. And it happens to be the same mother. Well,
right.
Why is it the same mother? Because it fits the same definite description. Our mothers both had the same name. They were born in the same place on the same date to the same parents. It's the same person. And they had and my mother had no twin sister. So it's the same mother. The one mother we both share fits the same definite description. So, well, what about Muslims, Jews, and Christians? Well, they all acknowledge there's one God and that he is the creator of the world and that he appeared to Abraham.
Right.
Now, Muslims and Jews don't acknowledge that he's a Trinity, but you don't have to know everything about somebody to be able to say they're the same person.
Right.
There can be undiscovered things or things that are known to one person that are not known to another. You might, if she was still alive, you might be able to meet my mother and know my mother, but there would still be things about her that I would know that you wouldn't.
Right.
And in the same way, Christians, because they have a special relationship with God, know things about God that others don't. Others, like Muslims and non-Jewish Christians or non-Christian Jews, can know about God. They just don't know all that Christians know about him. And so Dyer was seeming to presuppose that unless you have a robust understanding of the Trinity, that it's a different God. And that doesn't follow at all. That
right.
itself would involve a logical fallacy.
Right. And I think this is helpful, Jimmy, to underscore, because this comes up a lot sometimes among Catholics, especially when they look at, let's say, the Catechism quoting the Second Vatican Council. In paragraph 841, it talks about the church's relationship with Muslims. So it says, the plan of salvation also includes those who acknowledge the Creator, in the first place amongst whom are the Muslims. These profess to hold the faith of Abraham, which is a way of saying they don't really have the faith of Abraham, but they like to say their faith goes all the way back to Abraham, even though it starts with Muhammad. But the part that's more controversial is, and together with us, they adore the one merciful God, mankind's judge on the last day. And so some people will say, well, it's impossible for Muslims to adore the one God because they don't know that God is a Trinity. But I think that you've made the good point. You can have a relationship with someone, even if you don't know important facts about that individual. We could say similar things of this logic. I mean, it's taken so far, you could say that many Protestants, by that logic, wouldn't be worshiping God since they don't know that God is timeless or that he's simple and has no parts. But I think your reasoning here can also be helpful to people who struggle with that description in the Catechism. What do you think?
I think that it's helpful for people to understand more about how it's possible to have relations with persons, even if you don't know everything about them. I also think it's helpful to be aware of a little bit of the history here, because what the Catechism says is not at all controversial.
Right.
If you go back in, I mean, it is not some newfangled modern thing. If you go back to the Middle Ages, when Christendom was aggressively under attack by Muslim forces, the medieval theologians, not only St. Thomas Aquinas, but others as well, I mean, this was the standard view, would acknowledge that Muslims worship God. They would say they're wrong in a lot of their theological beliefs, but there was no doubt that, yeah, they worship the Creator just like we do. This was not controversial.
Right.
Where this controversy came from, as far as I've been able to establish, is actually from the Protestant community. Because what happened after the Reformation was you had Protestants had a problem of cognitive dissonance. That's where you are torn between two different ideas that seem to be in conflict with each other. Because everybody in Western Europe knew the Catholic Church, oh, that's the church Jesus founded.
Right.
And if you then want to say, actually, no, we need to break away from that, we need to form our own churches, then you need an alternative narrative to account for this massive church that's been there for 1,500 years that everybody acknowledges Jesus founded. And the counter narrative was to say, okay, it's not really the Catholic Church is not really the Bride of Christ, it's the Whore of Babylon. Mm-hmm. And we're the true Christians, and Catholics are not true Christians. And in order to say they're not true Christians, that must mean they're worshiping a false Christ. And so they have this false understanding of God, this false understanding of Christ. That's why they're not true Christians, and that justifies us in being in separation from them.
So at that time, they would not have said, Catholics and Protestants, though we differ, we both worship the one true Christ. They would say, no, we don't believe that at that time.
Well, many Protestants would agree to that, but others would not.
Okay.
And it's the others that became very common, their views became very common in American fundamental Protestantism in the early 20th century.
I see.
And so they would then say, okay, Catholics are not real Christians. They don't really worship the true Christ. They don't really worship the true God. And then they took the next logical step and said, well, if Catholics don't worship the true Christ or the true God, then obviously Muslims don't, because they're even less like us than Catholics are. Mm. And so this idea that Muslims don't worship the true God really got, from what I've been able to tell, really got started in fundamental Protestant circles, and I'm using the term carefully. There was a book of, there was a group of books in the early 20th century called The Fundamentals that were circulated in the Protestant community, and advocates of the books known as The Fundamentals were called fundamental Christians or fundamentalists. That's where the term comes from.
Right.
And that group of Christians then said, okay, Catholics aren't real Christians, Muslims don't believe in the real God, and then that view kind of backfilled into some Catholic and, I gather, Orthodox circles from Protestantism.
Interesting.
And I wonder if Jay Dyer may have I don't know the details of his biography. I wonder if he has a Protestant background and may have picked it up
I think he might have attended a Protestant seminary at one point. So I'd have to go back to his bio. It's interesting, Jimmy, the point you raise about this not being controversial. When you go back to the Catechism of St. Pius X, Pope St. Pius X, in the early part of the 20th, I think the first decade of the 20th century, this is what it says about Muslims, though it uses language that would get you canceled nowadays, but this is what it says in question 12. Who are infidels? Infidels are those who have not been baptized and do not believe in Jesus Christ, because they either believe in and worship false gods, as idolaters do, or like polytheists, or though admitting one true God, they do not believe in the Messiah, neither as already come in the person of Jesus Christ, nor as to come, for instance, Mohammedans and the like. So he makes a distinction there. You've got people who worship false gods, idolaters. You got some who believe in the one true God, but they don't recognize the Messiah. And they're not like Jews who recognize the law of Moses and hopeful Messiah. But it's interesting, even there, you see the recognition.
And one thing that I think could be interesting to bring up now concerning your debate was Dyer, as we said, placed a great deal of emphasis on the ambiguity of the term God.
Right.
And how it can mean different things. And he pointed out, and he was correct on this, that terms like hypostasis and prosopon, which are the terms connected with the word person,
right,
in the early ecumenical councils, really acquired their technical meaning at these councils.
Right.
And he's right about that. They did. And hypothetically, you could say, well, if you're going to use these terms precisely, then we need to acknowledge how they were formed, and that's quite true. But it doesn't mean you have to use those terms in right. their technical senses as your starting point for dealing with someone. One of the things that you find out if you study the history of religion, including Christianity and Judaism, is the terms for God, you know, were widely shared. They were not unique to the Jewish people or to the early church. So in Hebrew, you have terms like El and Elohim, which both mean, and Elah, all of which mean God. In Greek, the word is Theos for God. And these terms have a wide range of meaning. And Dyer even pointed some of this out, that Elohim can mean different things. It can mean...
like a judge, even.
Yeah, I find that the case for that somewhat limited, but it certainly can mean different things. In the Old Testament, right. you can show that the term refers to even departed human souls, for example, and the one true God that's the creator, and the gods of all the other nations, and things like that. Now, the people in the ancient world, prior to the Council of Nicaea, did not have a robust, precise understanding of the Trinity. In fact, if you're talking to a typical polytheist about a God, and so I'm going to tell you about my God here. He's the true God. He's the creator. Well, you're giving them information they wouldn't already have, because to them, most gods were not creators. They were finite beings that were actually created beings themselves and were part of creation.
Right.
And so if you look at, if you are aware of, okay, this is how the term God was being used, it was being used in this very broad, unrefined sense. But the natural starting point for talking to someone is using the language they're already familiar with. So I'm going to talk to a pagan about God, and I'm going to tell him about the true God. And right. we see Paul doing this in Acts 17. And Paul does not say, okay, guys, we need to begin by redefining our term God. Here is what prosopon and in Latin and hypostasis in Greek mean in the context of this discussion. There is one God in three persons, and now let's start talking about him. That's not the first thing Paul does. Paul starts with, oh, I saw you had an altar to an unknown God. And the Athenians had reasoned that, okay, there's going to be a God that's not part of our pantheon, but we ought to show him worship. You know, we ought to show him reverence. So let's do that. We'll make an altar to an unknown God. And they were right.
Right.
And Paul says, what you've worshipped in ignorance, I now proclaim to you. So Paul acknowledges they were legitimately worshiping God.
Right. They were giving him
even
worship.
Even though they knew nothing about him and certainly did not understand him as a Trinity. And so what Paul then does is he takes their naive, unformed view of this God that contains elements of falsehood because they're not assuming that this God is the creator,
right?
Much less that he's a Trinity. And then he begins to purify it and refine it and give them a deeper knowledge of it. And that's essentially the strategy that is used in classical apologetics. You start with a broad understanding of God that you can prove by looking at the world, and then you progressively refine that picture and supplement it by divine revelation and so forth to give people a more accurate, detailed knowledge of God. And so we see that in Scripture. We also see the same thing in science. Mm-hmm. One of the things that occurred to me as I was listening to Dyer state his case is that there's essentially, just off the top of my head, I immediately saw a parallel in physics. Mm-hmm. So originally, since the time of Aristotle, there was this theory that matter was made of these four classical elements, maybe with a fifth up in outer space, and that matter was infinitely divisible, that there was no smallest unit of matter. So you could just infinite, if you had wood, you could infinitely divide the wood into smaller and smaller chunks. And then after the scientific revolution began in the 1600s, you had a revival of this idea from some Greek philosophers called atomism, the idea that, okay, atoms are the smallest unit. And that was proved, or something like it was proved, in 1905 by Albert Einstein.
Yeah, atom, it doesn't that mean like
you can't cut.
Yeah,
exactly. And then it turns out, okay, well, we found atoms as these smallest particles beyond which it ceases to be whatever it is. If it's gold, there's a fundamental unit of gold that's an atom of gold. And then it turns out, oh, they're made out of smaller things. Hmm. And we then identified electrons and protons and neutrons, which are the three kinds of particles that atoms are made of. And then by the 1960s, we found, oh, it starts to look like protons and neutrons are made out of smaller things called quarks.
Right.
And as far as we know right now, quarks are as small as it gets. There may well be smaller particles, but as far as we know, quarks are the smallest. So let's suppose that that's the truth, that quarks are the most fundamental particles. Well, how did our knowledge of matter develop? Well, it started with a broad unreflective understanding, you know, based on Aristotle's views, and then we figured out, oh, and atoms exist, and then we figured out, oh, protons and neutrons exist, and then we figured out, oh, quarks exist. And so we had this progressive refinement of our understanding of the structure of matter. And suppose then, if quarks are fundamental, well, the properties of quarks are going to explain the properties of all the larger units.
Hmm.
And so if you could start by saying, okay, let's presuppose these things about quarks. And if we do, it'll make better sense of the world, the material world we see around us, than if you make other assumptions like quarks aren't real or they behave some other way.
I see.
And yeah, it's true. Once you reach the point of quarks, you can say, okay, our beliefs about quarks better explain the world than an alternative set of beliefs. So we could develop a kind of physics presuppositionalism around quarks. But that's
you have to get there first.
That's not how we got to quarks.
Right.
And in the same way, how people get to God is typically not by leaping straight to the Trinity level. It's certainly not how it played out in history revelation.
And that's what I think was a controversial point in the debate. And I've seen online some individuals, you might call them more, and I don't know how this is cashed out in Eastern Orthodoxy, whether it's a primary view. I suspect it's more fundamentalist, if you will, that, mm-hmm. oh no, the patriarchs and possibly even any of the Jews worshiping Yahweh, they knew God was a Trinity. I thought that was a very odd thing. And I was very clear. I said, mm-hmm. knowing that, because you could believe in God and you would, if God is a Trinity, you unknowingly believe, or you have implicitly in seeing God's glory, you see the Trinity. But I was clear, well, no, these people did not have the same knowledge of the Trinity we do.
Yeah. And the claims that Dyer appeared to be making regarding knowledge of the Trinity prior to the time of Christ, to put it charitably, would be very difficult to support historically. He, at one place, quoted Jesus as saying that Abraham had a knowledge of the Trinity because Jesus refers to Abraham as having seen me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a misquotation. I assume he's going by memory there, but that's a misquotation of John 8. And what Jesus actually says in John 8 is that Abraham rejoiced that he would see my day.
Mm-hmm.
And that can mean a bunch of different things, like Abraham believed in the resurrection of the dead and therefore would be alive in the future messianic age. That does not mean Abraham believed that God was three persons, one right. of whom was Jesus. That's a different claim. Now, you can show that there were intimations mm-hmm. of the idea of some kind of plurality in the Godhead prior to the time of Christ. It would mm-hmm. be very, it would be hard to say, you know, 1000 BC in the time of King David, or even further back than that, in the time of Abraham, that this was the case. But you can show that in the centuries leading up to the time of Jesus, there was some awareness that there may be a plurality in the Godhead. And so you had some figures, some authors talking about, like, okay, there's Yahweh, and then there's the lesser Yahweh, who can be identified with the angel of Yahweh.
Right.
And that actually is what Jesus is in getting himself in trouble with when he's in front of the high priest. And the high priest says, tell us plainly if you are the Son of the Blessed. And Jesus says, well, from now on, you're going to see the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. And that's a reference to Daniel, to the book of Daniel.
Right.
And that passage in Daniel is one of the ones that was taken as applying to the second Yahweh is coming alongside Yahweh. And so that's why the high priest, so Jesus is saying, yeah, I'm the second Yahweh. And that's why the high priest then tears his robes and says, you've heard the blasphemy. Why do we need any more witnesses? And this became known as the two powers in heaven doctrine. And in the second century and following, it was deemed heretical in the Jewish community to hold to the two powers in heaven doctrine. But it was there, at least in the centuries right up to the time of Christ, but it wasn't clearly formulated.
Right.
And certainly not everybody had the understanding Jesus of Nazareth is the divine Son of God.
Right.
If Caiaphas had had that understanding, he wouldn't have torn his robes.
Right, yeah, and that's why I picked the patriarchs and then even just like a faithful Jew in the exile, that they worshiped God, but they did not know God is a Trinity. If they did, why wasn't knowledge of the Trinity more, you know, more widespread? I think I agree with you that historically it's just
you can't support it.
Yeah, it's an untenable position. Instead, that no, you're right. When we understand who God is, God's revelation is progressive. We see that through salvation history, and helping people come to know who God is. And I think a strength of classical apologetics is that it really coheres with human nature that we learn things in a progressive way. It's like how God treats us. If you look at salvation history, he took people step by step, learning who he was, what his saving plan was, instead of just dumping it on everyone right at the beginning to be grossly misunderstood. I think we can learn a lot from that as classical apologists, that we kind of walk people through understanding God and his revelation in a kind of progressive way.
Mm-hmm. By the way, we focused on classical apologetics and presuppositionalism. We probably should at least briefly mention some of the other approaches.
Yeah.
So another approach is called evidentialism. Mm-hmm. And this is similar to classical apologetics, except you don't have to prove the existence of God first. So you don't have to say, let's step back and look at the world and reason our way to God. Instead, you can say, let's step back, look at the world. Do we see miracles like the resurrection of Jesus? Or if we're having a contest with the prophets of Baal, whose sacrifice gets burned by fire from heaven and whose doesn't? And what does that tell us about who God is? Is it
right,
Yahweh or Baal? And so you could, on an evidentialist approach, or you could call it a miracleist approach, you look for miracles that you can then infer things about the divine. Mm-hmm. So if you see, oh, Jesus is raised from the dead, we have good evidence for that, well, then Jesus, as the one who was resurrected, is qualified to interpret this event for us. And he says, well, I was raised by the one true God who's the creator, and I'm his son. Okay, that's good to know. And you've just given us good evidence for that by rising from the dead.
And that's similar to what we read in Acts. It seems that's very central to the proclamation of the apostles, that Jesus's identity is vindicated by his miracles.
Exactly, and particularly by the resurrection. And so this is an approach that has traction in Scripture. Another approach is known as the cumulative case approach.
Oh, before we jump to cumulative case, thoughts on that? Yeah, I would say it's interesting. Presuppositionalism and classical apologetics seem very apart, though I think we have discussed their commonalities where they can merge together. I think evidentialism and classical apologetics share much more in common, and we'd only, someone who would identify more as a classical apologist, and that's kind of the tack that I'm most oriented towards would find a large amount of agreement. I would especially say if you are engaging another theist, like a Muslim, for example, or someone else, I think miracles might be the arrow that kind of breaks the symmetry between the religions. My only concern is I think that for non-religious people or atheists, it can be difficult for them to entertain the possibility of miracles and the laws of nature being broken if there isn't a supreme, if they don't already believe there's a supreme power in governing the universe that is capable of doing that, if you see where I'm going with that.
I do. And it can, and that kind of points in the direction of the last of the methodologies that I want to mention.
Sure.
But I'll get there in just a moment. Just serving it quickly. Cumulative case apologetics is the idea that the truth of the Christian faith doesn't rest in a certain set of propositions that you prove one by one in a systematic manner, like in classical apologetics. First, we prove God exists. Then we prove Christ is his son. Jesus is the Christ. Then we prove that the Catholic Church is Christ's church. That's a kind of stepwise ordered proof, kind of like a mathematical proof. You do it one step at a time.
Right.
And the cumulative case view says, okay, maybe that works, but that's not what convinces most people. For most people, it's more like a lawyer in a court. A lawyer in a court presents a bunch of different pieces of evidence that each contribute something towards proving his case, mm-hmm. but it's not like a mathematical proof. It's not like a mathematical demonstration. Mm-hmm. And so advocates of the cumulative case view would include people like C.S. Lewis, for example. My view is sort of a – so let's see. We did classical, presuppositional, evidential, cumulative case – there's also another one called Reformed epistemology, but that's very specialized. We probably don't want to get too far into that.
Yeah, that's fine.
The view that I take is a practical
view.
Yeah, it's a practical one, and I call it toolbox apologetics. And the idea is what you're trying to do, the apologist is like a workman who is trying to help a client. And just like if you have a plumber or a carpenter over to your house, you have something you need doing, fixing, and he's going to have certain tools and in his toolbox. And what tool he pulls out will depend on the nature of the thing you need fixed. And so my approach is to say, okay, I'm like a workman. The person I'm talking with is my client. They have something they need fixed, whether it's a false belief or a lack of confidence or something like that. And what I'm going to approach them with is not a systematic program, unless they happen to need it. It's not going to be a systematic program of, let's start and by proving the existence of God and move to smaller things, or let's start with miracles and jump to God, or let's start by presupposing a triune God. I mean, maybe an individual person needs that approach.
Right.
But I shouldn't be thinking inside of those boxes. I should be aware of them so I can use them if needed, but many people need something completely different. And the example I use to illustrate this is back in the 1990s, right after email became a thing, I got an email from a woman in a Muslim country, and the email was titled, "My Heart is Searching for God." And it turns out this woman had been raised Muslim but had gone to America for college, and she had seen Christian society in America and how it differed from Muslim society. And what specifically spoke to her was the treatment of women in Christian culture compared to in Muslim culture. And so in writing her "My Heart is Searching for God" email to me, what she wanted to know was not does God exist or who is his prophet. She wanted to know what is the Christian view of women. And that's what she needed addressed. And it would have been stupid of me to try to back up and say, well, let's talk about how we know God exists and how Jesus is his son and how the Catholic Church is his church. What she needed was an understanding of the Christian view of women. and how it differed from what she had been taught, you know, which she was already aware of, obviously. And so that's an illustration of how I think apologists need to be responsive and adaptive and take this toolbox approach
right.
to the needs of individual people rather than trying to mainline everybody through one of the classical systems, as useful as those systems can be in individual yeah. circumstances.
Yeah, your approach reminds me, two scripture verses come to mind. One is 1 Corinthians 9, where Paul says, to the Greeks I became a Greek, to the Jews a Jew, I become all things to all men that I might win some.
Yeah.
So he modifies, and we see this in scripture when Paul is debating other Jews, he'll cite the Old Testament. In Acts 17, speaking to the Greeks, he makes no mention of the Messiah or the Old Testament. Because that wasn't common ground that they shared. The other is Matthew 6:21, where Jesus says, where your treasure is, there also your heart will be. So like with this woman, like her, you know, what she, you're starting with, what is it the person values the most, and how is that better incorporated at the time?
At the moment.
Yeah, at the moment. At the moment, what do they value the most, and how is that incorporated into the Christian or into the Catholic worldview? So yeah, I think that's really helpful. One last thing that we can discuss a little bit are kind of the foundational elements. I think the only other major argument that Jay brought up, and this kind of got hammered home more in the cross-examination and Q&A, was, well, we have to have foundational things to believe in, and the only way to have foundation, which is very presuppositional, the only way to have sure belief in anything is to start with God, even though it's a kind of circular reasoning that we're doing because we already believe in God. It seemed like Jay was saying, well, there's no such thing as self-evident truths. Even God is not self-evident, but there is a foundational truth, even if we get there in a circular way with God. And so we had a disagreement about, and I mentioned a piece of jargon called, I think it's called Agrippa's Trilemma.
Yes, and that also known as Munchausen's Trilemma.
Right. And this is the question of how do we know what we know, which is also a key dispute between classical apologetics and presuppositional. Might be helpful to discuss that a little, but the mainstay of the trilemma, and I tried hard in the short time I had to explain this, that to say that I know X is true, you know, okay, well, how do you know it's true? There's like three options. You could keep saying, how do you know that? How do you know that? How do you know that? Infinitely, and that would be the infinite regress, but it seems like we couldn't really know anything if we just had infinite regresses. You could say, well, I know this is true, I know A is true because of B, and B is true because of C, and C is true because of A. And you could do that, which would be a circle, but that seems circular reasoning just seems illogical too. The other option then would be foundationalism. Well, I know A is true, because when I consider A, I do know it's true. It's self-evident to me. And that was kind of, a heart of our kind of disagreement for Jay saying, well, we can't do natural theology because it relies on self-evident truths. And he's very skeptical we can have any of those without God. So I guess that's the best way I can re-summarize that part of the debate for everyone we were disagreeing about.
Yeah. In this case, what strikes me is that the two of you were, well, perhaps I shouldn't say it that way. So this is another issue where he was getting into some pretty deep philosophical waters, because he was the one that brought up foundationalism.
Right.
And foundationalism, for people who may not be aware, is a subject that comes up in philosophy in a field called epistemology, which is the study of knowledge, what knowledge is, how we know it, and so forth. And the question is, if you believe something, what's your justification for that belief? Why should you believe that rather than something else? And then this gets us into different theories of justification. One of the theories of justification is known as foundationalism. And the idea is that you should have a solid foundation for all of your beliefs. And so let's say I believe in electrons. Well, I should have a solid foundation for that that's presumably based in experiments that have been run. And, well, how do I know those experiments work? Well, it goes back to even deeper principles. The classic version of foundationalism was proposed by René Descartes, the French philosopher. And he said, okay, I'm going to use a method of doubting everything I can, and I'm going to strip away anything I could possibly doubt, and I'm going to get down to a set of things I cannot doubt, and then that will be my foundation that I build all of the rest of my knowledge on. And he got down to, I think, therefore I am. And Dyer pointed out that that itself has been subject to criticism, which is true. Just because you appear to think doesn't mean you're actually thinking. And just because something seems to be the case doesn't mean it actually is the case. So there have been alternate proposals like, I appear to think, therefore there is the possibility of a thought. And even that you can question. But in the debate, you were advocating a version of foundationalism, and he was taking exception to that. He was saying, no, we shouldn't try to find undoubtable or obviously true beliefs. We should instead just presuppose certain beliefs. And it's legitimate to do that because there's no effective alternative. And that's a debate that can be had. Personally, my inclination is I'm sort of a naturalist in that I start by looking at how do people actually form their beliefs. And I don't think they use foundationalism or presuppositionalism. I think that they have – I tend to favor what's called the coherence theory of justification in terms of what people actually do. People have a certain set of beliefs. Some of them are innate. They're programmed into us before we're born. They fall right out of our genome. But we have a certain set of beliefs, and then we take in data and we form new beliefs based on that data, and we have this kind of web of belief. That's a an image that's often been used for coherentism. And then we modify our beliefs based on new data. And I think that's how people actually form their beliefs. And it's an interesting academic question. Well, suppose we're imagining an idealized person. How would an idealized person do it? And I think in if you're asking that, well, ultimately you're going to run into some fundamental axioms because infinite regresses don't work with finite human consciousness. There has to be a starting point. The question is, what's the reasonable starting point? And I have some sympathies to foundationalism here in that I think there are certain, if we're thinking about an idealized thinker, there are certain starting assumptions that seem very hard to deny. They are so intuitive, like law of non-contradiction. It's so intuitive. It's very hard to imagine thinking without a principle like that. And so I, even though they might be doubtable in some sense, I think they so strongly recommend themselves to us that they are a logical starting point.
And I would agree with you. And I didn't want the debate to be too derailed into specific theories of foundationalism because there are different ways.
I felt like Dyer should have, like Dyer, if you want to debate these issues, just have a debate on epistemology.
Right. And that's what he tried to take to boil natural theology down just to this particular question. But I think most people, when they just start to think about it, no, there are beliefs that seem evident to me, you know, something can't be true and not true at the same time. A skeptic can always doubt anything. It's just kind of what they do. But just because the skeptic makes a doubt doesn't mean I necessarily have to entertain it or take it seriously as I'm just living my life and assembling beliefs to do my best to understand the world. And so I think natural theology plays the good role in that. And I also, in that factor of pointing out, it seemed really like we both agreed, hey, you got to have a starting point to understand the world. But I still think one of the fatal flaws is going to be if we try a presupposition that is only justified in a circular way, if it's only justified in a circular way, then you have no way to know which presupposition you should choose. Or at least, especially someone on the outside, looking at all the different presuppositions, how are they supposed to do that without some kind of objective way to make a decision amongst them, if you see what I'm saying.
I do. I think that what a presuppositionalist would say is, well, by presupposing, by using my set of presuppositions and then thinking through the evidence we have from the world, mine makes better sense of the world, of the evidence we have from the world compared to other views. So like my view allows coherent thought and other views wouldn't. Now you've then got to argue that. Is that really the case?
Right.
You know, like Dyer seemed to be arguing that only by presupposing a specifically Trinitarian God could you even have coherent thought.
And that's what I found. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
And maybe that's true, but you got to argue that. That is not prima facie obvious.
And not just that. When he's made the argument before, he says the God of Orthodox with a capital O, or the God of Eastern Orthodox Christian faith, that for Dyer, he's very particular that it's not the true God unless it has, and I'll throw jargon out here, but it's not important for us to know what it means, something called an energy essence distinction,
right?
Having these very particular elements of Eastern Orthodox thought baked into it. And I find that highly implausible. So wait, you're saying that we couldn't have logic or knowledge or morality if God is the absolutely simple God of, you know, not simple to understand, but he doesn't have metaphysical parts, the God of Catholic theology or the God of Protestant theology, who is Trinitarian, can't give us knowledge, logic, and morality, but only the Eastern Orthodox God of theology can do that. And that I find, you could make an argument for that, you say, but I already find it pretty suspicious of it that case can be made.
Yeah, and this is another thing that I think was a failure on Dyer's part in terms of making his case, because it was not clear for much of the debate. This line of thought is something that emerged relatively late in the discussion. And what I would do if I'm debating someone, what I do try to do is identify all of the common ground we have first.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, to show I'm nice and to show I'm reasonable.
Yeah.
But also to set it aside, because
right,
once we've identified where we agree, we can then move on to, well, what do we actually disagree on? And we don't have to be casting our minds back and forth trying to figure out what we agree on and what we don't. It's much better structurally in a debate to say, here's what we agree on. Now let's put that aside and talk about what we don't agree on.
Yeah, and that's
and
why
he did not do that. He was all over the map. It was virtually impossible to follow what he was saying for more than a few seconds at a time.
Yeah, and that's why I asked things like, you know, do you think we should provide evidences for particular aspects of revelation, like fulfilled messianic prophecy? And he agreed with that. And so I think that especially people, and that's why for me, there'll be a lot of people who support Jay and maybe use this apologetic methodology, or we'll meet Protestants who use a similar kind of methodology. And I would say, well, hey, it's good that you're going out and sharing the gospel and talking to people and helping them to come to know God and Jesus and his son, Jesus Christ. Then the more I can find common ground, and if I could say, hey, give this historical argument too, it's really helpful, then I think that fits into that toolbox approach you were mentioning earlier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think in a way there's something audacious, and I think that my impression is that Dyer strives for audacity, but there's something audacious into trying to say, not only do you have to presuppose the existence of God, and not only the Christian God, but specifically my denominational understanding of the Christian God, and try to use it as a sort of bootstrap into Eastern Orthodoxy approach.
Yeah.
I think it would be, sure, as a Catholic apologist, I'd love it if I had a one-stop, you must be Catholic to understand anything argument.
A Catholic ontological argument would just be wonderful.
But but I think that's a little too convenient. I think that even if such an argument existed, it would transcend the ability of most people to benefit from it. And it's just going to be better to reach people where they are and not try to prove everything all at once and to take a more piecemeal approach.
I would agree with that. Jimmy, thanks so much for coming on the show. Are there any resources you would like to recommend, and also where people can learn more about you? I think one resource probably in both of our heads If you want to learn more about different apologetic methodologies and how they differ from one another, there is a series put out, I think it's by Zondervan, a point counterpoint series where they have books on all different kinds of religious subjects. Usually it's disputes among Protestant authors. There are a few cases where they invite Catholic authors to give a particular point of view. You usually see that in their books on faith and works and justification. But they do it. There's a Five Views book on it's apologetics.
Five Views of Apologetics. The editor was Steve Cowan, C-O-W-A-N, who was my old office mate in grad school.
We were in
the same philosophy program. And so I know him personally. I was delighted. He's an evangelical. And I was delighted to see when his book, Five Views of Apologetics, came out. And he explores, he has different people writing from the different perspectives, and they debate each other on the different merits of these. Also, if you'd like an assessment of the different views from their strengths and weaknesses, their contributions and limitations from a Catholic point of view, check out my Introduction to Apologetics course at the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics. Just go to schoolofapologetics.com, and it's the Introduction to Apologetics course that you want, and I go through the different methodologies as well as a lot of other stuff to introduce the topic.
Perfect. And then, of course, everyone, don't forget to check out Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World podcast. Where can people go and find that?
It's all over wherever you find podcasts and on the internet. So just type in Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World and it will come up. This episode is going to go out Monday, right?
We're probably going to shoot for Wednesday of first week in November. So you have stuff coming up for November?
Yeah, so for Friday, well, for November in general, we're going to start on the first Friday of November by talking about the reported canals of Mars that were spotted by astronomers in the 1900s and how they led to a big enthusiasm for the idea there was a civilization on Mars. Then the second Friday, we're going to look at the scientific evidence we have concerning whether there is life on Mars. And we have more evidence than you might think. Then for the third Friday in Mars, we're going in November, we're going to be it's going to be the 50th anniversary of D.B. Cooper, the famous hijacker who was very gentlemanly and leapt out of the plane in mid-flight, taking the money with him, and was never seen again. So we're going to be looking at the mystery of D.B. Cooper.
Until his series on Disney Plus.
Yes. So lots of interesting stuff coming up.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds wonderful. So everyone, be sure to check out Jimmy's course, schoolofapologetics.com, as well as Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Jimmy, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure.
And thank you guys for watching. I hope you all have a very blessed day.
If you liked today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.